Now, this is Box to Box with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley.
Oh, what a goal!
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and
moving. Absolutely fantastic!
Hello and welcome to Box, the show that is everything football. You're with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley to run the rule over the past week in the World Game. First edition news with Willem van Denderen shortly, and as always, we'll be joined during the show by our former ITN journo turned pundit, Derek Dyson. Now, under most circumstances, with the Socceroos making history to become the first nation in World Cup qualifying history to win 11 consecutive matches in a single qualification campaign following their decisive win against Oman, it would be a no contest as to what led this week's show. But not even that story can knock off this week's expose into allegations of sexual abuse within the Matildas, which exploded across the Australian football landscape just days ago when News Limited Papers published Lisa Devanna's account of bullying, sexual harassment and grooming, which she says began when she first joined the Matildas camp at the age of 17. Soon we'll talk at length with one of Australia's most respected journos and authority on sports administration, the ABC's Tracy Holmes, to unravel what we can of the story so far and how we can expect it to play out over the coming months. Of course, there is plenty of football on the pitch, so we'll wrap up the Socceroos results off the top of the show and then look at the Matildas on the park with Willem. Another huge story this week was, of course, Perth Glory signing former Liverpool and England star Daniel Sturridge for the upcoming A-League season. We'll talk to the Glory's football operations manager and former star of the domestic league himself, Terry McFlynn, about how that deal was done and what the club is expecting Sturridge will bring to the table. And of course, we'll wrap it up with our extended stoppage time as Derek and the rest of the team recap some of the other big stories of the week. Edge, we sort of seem to say it every week, don't we? But, you know, so many, many big stories to cover. But this, well, you know, when Lisa responded to Megan Rapinoe's email about the scenario in the US, I don't think any of us expected what was to come in the 48 hours afterwards.
Hi, Rob. Great to be with you again and to our listeners right around Australia and all over the world. Before I sort of respond to that Lisa, the Lisa question you asked me, I wanted to just acknowledge the Socceroos' triumph. It's 11 in a row, 10 wins on foreign soil. It's a remarkable achievement. They're now in the FIFA records. They should be incredibly happy with themselves. Despite some nervous defending, especially in the first half, they got the job done. And I just want to acknowledge off the top of the show that is just a wonderful achievement that everybody in football should be very, very proud of. But yeah, the revelations of historical abuse communicated by Lisa Devanna, Raleigh Dobson, Renee Isseruf and Bronwyn Nutley, yeah, they've been shocking, haven't they? And they really have weighed heavily on everybody in the sport. And obviously the first thing to mention, Rob, is that we hope all of these women are getting ongoing welfare support and that their grievances can be investigated and appropriately dealt with. But Rob, it's a complex set of circumstances and one that swimming, hockey, even Australian rules football, they've had some historical abuse allegations in the past 6 weeks. Surf, life-saving, gymnastics, all of those sports are currently grappling with what football is, and I'm looking forward to talking with Tracy and we can unpack some of the specific issues for our sport. But yeah, it's been a difficult week for everybody who's close to women's football.
Yeah, it sure has been, mate. So we'll get stuck into it. And we'll talk at length, as I said off the top, with Tracy a little longer perhaps than we would normally do, because there just is so much to cover. And Tracy, you know, covers it in her own right on her podcast, The Ticket, and on the ABC. But it'll be interesting, as it always is, to get her personal views as opposed to being the one asking the questions. All right, well, Willem, you've got it all. Let's kick it off, mate.
G'day, guys. It has been a huge week in football, but you did both manage to get to my top point before I got to it, but that's okay. The Socceroos have become the first side in World Cup history to win 11 straight World Cup qualifiers in the same campaign. The most recent one, of course, this morning's win, 3-1 over Oman in Dubai. Al-Mabil opened the scoring for Australia, but it was far from easy beyond that. Almander Al-Alawi levelling the score as Oman's front third threatened consistently. The second half saw Australia steady, the prolific Martin Boyle and Mitch Duke adding to their impressive international tallies. Michael, you're a man who knows the recent and the extended history of the Socceroos better than anyone, and this campaign is reminding me a little bit of 2010 under, of course, the late Pim Verbeek. We're not dominating. You could pick holes in the performance if you wanted to, but I much prefer this to the mad scramble that we've seen in the past two campaigns under Holger Osiek and Postecoglou.
Absolutely, Willem. It is there is memories of 2010 campaign. That was a wonderful campaign. We were unbeatable. Extremely different coaching approach, extremely different setup in the team. And obviously in 2009 and 2010, as we went through that process, we had, that was the tail end of the golden generation with some awesome, massive names. And who could forget Tim Cahill's just consistently scoring headers against Japan in those big games. But this this team rightly can stand alongside that team at the moment. They are taking all before them. And the boiler who said to FIFA during the week that when Australia approached him, he sort of treated it as a bit of a joke for a while, but has become one of our key movers, and he scored his fifth goal in 9 games. Remarkable achievement from the boiler, and well done to, as I said off the top of the show, Willem. They really are doing all of us proud in difficult circumstances. I can't wait until that moment when they return to home soil and all of the football fans, who many of them listen to us, will be out in force to give them the greatest welcome. And won't that be a sensational atmosphere when we can pack the stands and cheer on and give them the support that they rightfully have earned and deserve.
To the Asian qualifiers, more broadly, Japan have again dropped points and their World Cup campaign is in real trouble. A 1-0 loss to Saudi Arabia, meaning they'll almost certainly have to qualify through the third place playoff. Elsewhere in Group B, China earned their first points of the stage with a 3-2 win over Vietnam. While over in Group A, it's turning into a bit of an arm wrestle. Iran defeated the UAE 1-0, so they topped the group on 9 points. South Korea are behind them on 7, having beaten Syria 2-1. And Iraq and Lebanon played out a nil-all draw. So, Michael, I'll throw back to you. The Socceroos will, of course, play Japan on Tuesday evening. You would think the coach there, Hajime Moriyasu, if they were to lose that one, he might be on his way.
Yeah, they're in all sorts of trouble, aren't they? Their pressure is on them massively. If they lose against the Socceroos, they'll be looking at really third place, best result, you would think. Look at a two-horse race at the moment, our group between ourselves and Saudi Arabia, and a very big opportunity for Australia to really put the screws on Japan. And also, you would think if we beat Japan, it's going to be highly unlikely we won't qualify directly. And when we looked at the draw with them, when we looked at all of the qualifiers that Australia had to play, we noticed the three tough games in the last three matches. But theoretically, we could have qualified before we had that difficult run. And don't forget, we play on the last fixture against Saudi Arabia in Riyadh. So it could be all well and done by that time. And touch wood, I don't want to jinx anything, but that would be fabulous if it was.
Rob, let's go to your boys, Italy. Their world record 37-match unbeaten run at international level has ended. It's going to stand at 37. A youthful Spain it was, who defeated them 3-1 to advance to Sunday's Nations League final. Spanish manager Luis Enrique handed a start to 17-year-old Gavi. They just keep getting younger and younger, these talented Spaniards. And it was 21-year-old Ferran Torres who did the damage. In the other semi-final, France defeated Belgium 3-2, courtesy of goals to Kylian Mbappe, Karim Benzema and Theo Hernandez. So two brilliant Nations League semi-finals. So Rob, the streak, what a run it's been. It is over and they're not going to win the Nations League, but I don't think they'll be too fussed because they won the Euros. And of course, the World Cup is the biggest fish that Mancini wants to fry.
Of course, Spain made the semi-finals of the recent Euros and a rising power, a re-rising power of European football. So no surprise there that they were going to be competitive and taking Italy on. But, as you say, Italy might be too concerned about not winning the Nations Cup after they won the Euros. They'll be more looking forward to Qatar next year.
Newcastle United's takeover by a Saudi-backed consortium has been approved by the Premier League after the league received assurances that the state will not control the club. The club have been sold by Mike Ashley for £305 million, ending his unpopular 14-year reign. Thousands of fans celebrated Ashley's era ending outside St James's Park. But, Rob, there is, of course, a very significant moral objection to the new ownership as well. We've covered on this program the death of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, and his wife continues to be prominent in the press speaking out against his government. So it'll be interesting to see if it becomes public just how strong those assurances were that this will be a separate body running the club.
The Saudis are not the first country to be accused of sports washing. I mean, this is gold star sports washing at its best. So the question then for Newcastle is how do their fans respond to it? And I think what you'll end up finding is that there'll be a lot of pragmatism through most of them, that that you know they have an expectation that that their position in the football firmament is a lot higher than what it should be, and they'll be just pointing the finger at the other club, saying, well, if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for us. So I know we'll talk about the nuance of this story and this ownership as months play out, but it's not ideal, but it sadly is the way of the world.
And a final one from me, Watford have signed Claudio Ranieri as manager on a two-year deal, having sacked Zisco Munoz just 7 games into the season. The Hornets will be the Tinkerman's fourth English club after Chelsea, Fulham and famously Leicester. He departed Sampdoria at the end of last season. So, Michael, since Marco Silva was appointed head of Watford in 2017-18, they've had 7 full-timers, 2 caretakers, and you'd have to say it's particularly harsh on Munoz after winning promotion last year, and the last man to survive 2 seasons at Watford was Malky Mackay in 2009. So they've had 15 permanent managers since that point. Is the Tinker Man going to fare any better?
Well, you wouldn't think so, because, you know, 7 games and 7 points, I tell you, that's an average of a point a game. If he was to do that for the rest of the season, we can't now because Munoz's been sacked, but he would have ended up with 38 points, which is enough probably to be saved. And that's probably Watford's objective, isn't it, to remain in the top flight. I think it's an indictment on the management of that club. Look, the Tinker Man, he comes with a big reputation, and who could forget what he did at Leicester City. But for me, I'm disappointed because I actually think they've started the season pretty well.
And Rob, I got a little bit ahead of myself, but I did want to touch back on Newcastle on Steve Bruce. He's come out in a pretty morose sort of fashion. He said, well, new owners mean usually a new manager. I'm no chance to stick around. Poor old Steve.
Yeah, well, Steve, he's a genuine football man, isn't he? He was a player of great note in his day, and he's been through the coaching traps. He knows the way of the world. He knows he's not there for very long, and he'll just cop it sweet and he'll end up somewhere else. But we like Steve Bruce. He's
done a really
good
job.
Awesome.
Yeah. He's awesome. Remember when Benitez left and it was doomsday. Newcastle are going to drop back to the bottom of the Premier League relegation. Yeah. Steve Bruce, oh no, this guy's sort of yesterday's news, but he's done a brilliant job.
Yeah, no, it's off to Steve wherever you turn up. All right, well done, Edge. We're going to have a good yarn with Tracy Holmes after the break about this Matilda story that's exploded across the newspapers, the Australian media this week. There's a lot more to it, a lot more to come. Stick around after the break. Tracy Holmes from the ABC on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal.
Yes, this is Box to Box. Now, this week, Football Australia has been thrown into a firestorm of sexual assault allegations in a series of articles published in the News Limited newspapers, which have resonated around the football world. And as we're all aware, it began with Matilda's icon Lisa Devanna's allegations of same-sex sexual harassment, abuse and bullying earlier in her career. W League player Riley Dobson going on record as a target of same-sex harassment in her career. Former Matilda Renee Isseriff has called out a decade of abuse and improper behaviour by national team coaches, while former player Bronwyn Nutley has levelled abuse allegations at former elite coach Mark Jones. There are a lot of other elements to this story, which we hope to discuss and unpack in a reasonable way with one of the leading voices in sports journalism in Australia, from the Ticket, the ABC, Tracy Holmes. Welcome back to the show, Tracy.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Good to talk to you.
We're in the middle of this. We don't know where it ends, but we know that there are a lot of hurt people involved in this from every level. You've got a lot of experience in investigating complex sports stories. This one does come under the umbrella of a whole range of similar stories around the world at the same time. What's your feeling on the way that it's been published so far, and the reaction of Football Australia in the general community?
I think the reaction in the general community is probably what you'd expect from headlines that have been, you know, blaring out these allegations. But I think it's also very important to remember that, you know, there are processes that need to be followed at times like this. As desperately as people want it all to be all out in the open and solved, and we all know what's going on, sometimes it takes longer than that. And at the moment, they are allegations. They need to be reviewed and investigated thoroughly. And then whatever repercussions come from that will come. I think Football Australia has acted swiftly and decisively in appointing Sport Integrity Australia. And through this new umbrella framework, if you like, the National Integrity Framework, this will be the first big test for that, to see just how that investigation unfolds. If anything does go to a tribunal, it will be the National Sports Tribunal. Interestingly, the CEO of that is John Boultby, who used to be the high performance manager at Football Australia in years gone by. He's sort of moved through sporting circles. But there's a long way to go yet. And in fact, even before a Sport Integrity Australia investigation can begin, what is needed is for Lisa Devanna and these others to actually report an incident or take their stories and allegations to Sport Integrity Australia. That's the initial step. We don't know when that will happen or if that will happen.
And Tracy, again, in your experience, more often than not, these sort of stories seem to come to light through investigative journalism as opposed to organisations identifying issues. Why does this happen time and time again?
I think what normally happens is that people refer things to the channels that they think are going to, give them the satisfaction or the requirements that they're looking for or whatever outcome they're looking for. When that doesn't happen, inevitably it ends up leaking somewhere along the line and you read about it in the media first. Now, from what we've heard in this story so far, Football Australia has said that in a number of meetings they've had with Lisa Devanna and some of her team over the past months, perhaps even the last 18 months or 2 years, none of these specific allegations have been raised. So in this instance, it doesn't appear that there has been a cover-up from head office. It seems from what they say, and at the moment we can only go with what Lisa Devanna's team is saying against what Football Australia is saying, and they've said that the specific allegations she put in the media basically came as a surprise to them. They had not heard these, and these were not the cultural discussions that they were having with her. That was much more around other issues and her role in the team, and I guess the disappointment, in fact, of having her role within the team cut short from her point of view.
The obvious question that a lot of people are asking me is, what is so toxic about the culture of Australian high-performance football? We've heard the term toxic culture be bandied around. We heard the former coach of the Matildas, Alan Stajic, describe the culture that way. We've heard administrators describe the culture that way, and now we hear Lisa describe the culture. But what is so toxic about it?
It's a question that I put to Beau Bush today, who's the co-CEO at PFA, the Footballers Association. And that has also struck me, that it's interesting that 2 years ago, here we were talking about the results of a PFA survey, which was filled out by the players anonymously. And we know that what came from that was this toxic culture that had been discussed. There were elements within the environment of the Matildas that a lot of the players felt had homophobic overtones, and that didn't go down well. We then know that Football Australia commissioned their own independent review. What they found was that in the management of these professional teams and the high performance teams, there wasn't really an athlete-centric view that was being applied to the way these teams were being managed. And they thought there was much too heavy a reliance on the coach, you know, him or herself, whoever happened to be in the position, and that coaches were determining things like who should be captain, who should be part of the leadership group, where this independent panel thought, with their experience and collective, you know, years-long experience across any number of sports, that it should be handed back to the athletes themselves, so that they got to choose with some voice and some strength who they thought the leaders of their group should be. But they also made the point that if leaders are chosen, there needs to be some sort of a situation, a bit of an examination of whether they would be the right sorts of people for a leadership group, you know, whether they stood up to the right sorts of scrutiny and whether they'd had any leadership training. So these are all processes now that sports look at putting in place to guarantee that the best people for those jobs are in them and that the players themselves have a role and a responsibility in choosing, you know, who should lead them, who should captain them, etc. That had been missing. So now when we hear these, you know, allegations of a toxic culture again, and I'm very conscious of the way that it's been framed in some of the reporting, and, you know, there seems to be, it's an almost converse view of what we saw previously. So the question I put to Bo was whether, you know, is there a divide in this Matildas camp? Are we seeing a division along lines of sexuality? You know, are we seeing some people think that there's a homophobic culture? Are we seeing other people saying that, you know, it's the reverse, it's the flip side of that? Now, he said from all the work they've done with the Matildas, as a playing group, they have not discovered any concerning areas as far as division within the group goes. So we know there have been divisions before. We know Alan Stajic lost his job. There have been those sorts of issues. But as far as the playing group goes and their support for each other, Bo Bush at the PFA says that does not exist within the Matildas playing group.
Those people in the football community, a lot of them have been talking about the way Lisa Devanna was left out of the Olympics team. A lot of people, a lot of conjecture about whether she deserved to be given an opportunity there. She is one of the iconic figures in the Matildas team over the last decade, and I can't help think about the way Tim Cahill left the Socceroos setup in terms of the way he was celebrated, his achievements were celebrated, the way he embraced his move away from the team, the farewell match, those types of things. If you contrast to the way Devanna has left the Australian national team set up, has Football Australia botched this? Did they not celebrate her achievements as much as she might have deserved? And is this the first major blip on the reputation of James Johnson's led administration? Have they botched the way Lisa Devanna has left football?
You would hope that that she wouldn't leave this way. I think there needs to be a distinction, and of course there's just no comparison. If you look at the way she's been let go and the way, as you say, Tim Cahill was let go, completely different scenario. But I also think that the two teams, we need to look at this also in what they were going to compete in, what they were trying to excel at, to deliver on the promises that they've been making for a long time. And a lot of people have the expectation that this Matildas team is a world beater. So they were going for an Olympic gold medal. They're going to try and finish with the FIFA World Cup in 2023. So it was a different sort of pressure on both the coaching staff, the high performance staff, the players themselves, where there might have been a bit more leeway in, okay, let's provide Tim Cahill with one more game or a farewell match or something that we can all come and celebrate, a friendly that is not going to count in this regard. But I think we've seen, you know, from Stajic, we've had another coach, we've got the Olympic Games there, we've got the World Cup around the corner. It's a whole series, a different level of pressure that has been on this team that the coaches probably didn't have the sort of leeway that might have been available with Tim Cahill. So, you know, it's difficult, isn't it, to compare apples and oranges. But this also speaks to the fact that, you know, the Matildas are a highly regarded team with huge expectations. As yet, they haven't delivered on those expectations. So each time we go around, it gets tougher and tougher. The pressure builds more and more, and that builds on everybody. And so, unfortunately, then when it comes to decisions about who's playing, You're not thinking about longevity. You're not thinking about, oh, just one more cap means that she could equal the most ever. You know, two more friendlies means that she could be the best ever and probably deserves that, or the most capped ever. So, you know, there's a lot that goes into this. And like we know with all of these situations, it's never black and white. It's never clear cut. There are multiple layers and many different people with different pressures riding on their shoulders.
How much worse does this get before it gets better? I mean, allegations always have someone on the receiving end. What does the investigation find? There are obviously people who are those who are being accused in all of this, not just from Lisa, but from every one of the other players who have put their head up to go on the record. Are these people named and shamed? Are there criminal investigations that need to take place? This has got a fair way to go.
It's got a long way to go, but all of it, as I said right back at the start, very much depends on what Lisa and the other players that you mentioned earlier in the program now take to Sport Integrity Australia. So the framework is now set up for an independent investigation. And I know that a lot of people have been reaching out to Lisa with not much comeback, including the PFA. You're right, if there are allegations of grooming, that is illegal behaviour, that is criminal behaviour. That takes it to a whole new level of investigation. Harassment and bullying is not quite at that level, but it requires a thorough investigation, no less. So Sport Integrity Australia will now be promoting, you know, the tool or the website or the access points that Lisa and others can go to if they have these sorts of concerns for the investigation to begin. But until that happens, you know, as yet, we don't even have an investigation. As yet, there are not the sort of basic foundations for an investigation to begin until the players report.
Tracy, I think James Johnson hit the right tone in terms of saying that we were hearing, Lisa, that, you know, no stone should be left up unturned not to get to the bottom of this, and also where to make improvements moving forward with these types of reporting mechanisms. They need to be made. One item that occurs to me is that obviously you know, Lisa's had that experience, and we need to obviously reflect on what she said. But in the context of what she said, she obviously hasn't named any people who did that behaviour to her. And when she's not done that, therefore there is the obvious question that the football public says, well, who are the people that did that? And effectively now the spotlight goes on to anybody of that generation who was a lesbian. And there's obviously not all of them would have perpetrated in that type of behaviour. So those people must be feeling it too. Those people must be feeling like they're wrongly accused. So there's also those people to consider, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. And this is why, you know, it's a football-wide issue at the moment, and everybody's going to have an opinion. We know in football there's no limit to opinions and views and the way that people kind of absorb and filter through these types of scenarios and all the information that is required, and especially when there are missing links, as you say, and you know people haven't been named. But you can't name people when allegations are being made and an investigation hasn't yet happened. So, you know, that is the next step. By Football Australia, they were already in discussion with Sport Integrity Australia well and truly before this about moving and signing on to this national integrity framework. So it will be interesting to see how it unfolds. We know that many of the issues in the past come down to when people have allegations like Lisa has made. First of all, having the courage to come forward and to make those allegations, but then finding some sort of a link that you can trust, an organisation you can trust that you feel like is not going to sweep things under the carpet as may have been done in years gone by. And I think it's really important at this point to note that what's happened already, even with Sport Integrity Australia, with Football Australia making this move and decisively, swiftly there have been changes. You know, the groundwork has changed. And I think James Johnson was pretty adamant at making that point too. Society has changed, and any sport that isn't changing at the same rate as society is going to be left behind and in a really bad situation. So I've heard some people perhaps confusing or conflating, you know, historical allegations with the current situation. And I don't for a moment think that there are systemic issues like this in the current setup. I could be proved wrong tomorrow, but I highly doubt it, because advancements have been made, improvements are being made. We're seeing big shifts in this. We've seen it across a number of sports, and we know it's been happening internationally as well. So, you know, let's hope that the historic allegations are that they are historic, and this is not some sort of an undercover issue that too many people are hiding currently. I just don't think that could happen today because of the level of interaction across all sorts of layers. And let's also hope for Lisa, or for anybody that has been in a situation where they have been aggrieved to this extent, to the level of the allegations made, that there is proper recourse for all involved.
Well, Tracy, well said. Anyone who listens to this show will know that this conversation has been a longer one than we normally have, but it warrants that that introspection and considered look. We, as you do, Tracy, don't subscribe to the, you know, the salacious and the tabloid angles to this story. This is a real story about real people, and we hope that whatever does come out of it, we see change for the better, and that you know, those who have been hurt in any way find some healing as a result of it. So, Tracy, thanks again for coming on the show and having a chat about it, and we'll all watch with interest and listen to your podcast as well, The Ticket, where no doubt you'll be covering it all as well.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
Not at all, the ABC's Tracy Holmes. Listen to The Ticket. It's an outstanding podcast as well. You'll hear a lot more on this story with Tracy coming out. Okay, stick around. We've got a lot more on Box to Box after the break. We'll talk more Matildas after, well, we've covered the Socceroos earlier in the show. That's coming up next on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box. Great chat with Tracy Holmes just there. Very, very complex story. We hope we did it justice for you, but we will be obviously covering it over the next weeks and months as more emerges and the investigation gets underway. But we obviously will be talking plenty of football and plenty of Matilda and Socceroo football as we continue on, and that's what we're going to do right now. Willem, you have got a stack more news for us that doesn't involve the Socceroos.
Oh, I do, Rob. I wanted to start with Socceroos and Matilda's Central. Do you mind if I do include a few Socceroos? Because they had big weeks in clubland before they got into the World Cup squad.
Yeah, of course you can.
It is, of course, for the Green and Gold Army. Only 13 months to go until the Qatar World Cup, and packages are not too far away. So to make sure you're across all info regarding the tour, sign up to the mailing list at ggatravel.com.au. Jackson Irvine enjoyed a big day out in the centre of the park for St Pauli as they defeated Dynamo Dresden 3-0. Jackson played 90 minutes and St Pauli shot to the top of the Bundesliga 2. So all smiles for Jackson, as it was in a video, Michael, that emerged throughout the week of a young Jackson and a very Australian-looking Ernie Merrick enjoying a VB stubby, saying that Jackson will play for victory one day. Did you see the video?
I did see the video, and it was a great... Ernie Merrick has launched himself onto Twitter with about five of his first six tweets with zingers. And he's anybody who likes Twitter, make sure you follow Ernie. He's got some great stuff, and he's... I think he pretty much says to Jackson, go and get a beer, doesn't he? And Jackson's about eight.
This is my next question, Michael. Is it the real Ernest Merrick?
It is, mate. The real Ernest Merrick. Yes, it is, yeah.
Fantastic. Let's stay in Germany. Aiden Rustic came off the bench for Eintracht Frankfurt for the final stages of their boilover against Bayern Munich. They won 2-1 and they've moved clear of the relegation scrap, so a real career highlight there for Aiden. Moving to England, Harry Soutar continued to impress for Stoke City. They had a win over West Brom, and spotted in the stands was Everton assistant Duncan Ferguson. Now, the Toffees are expecting to lose Yerry Mina, and hopefully, from our perspective, Rob, are considering Harry a replacement, and you'd have to say that would be... certainly for all those people who doubted Harry when Graham Arnold selected him and said, this guy's just a beanpole, you've got him in for his height, that'd be a big justification for Arnie if Harry was to make the step up.
Yeah, well, speaking from height, he's just 2 centimetres short of 2 metres, 6'6" in the old. He's been great for Australia, hasn't he, in the Six Caps since he's been called up. He's been a real target man, and as anyone who's been following Stoke in the Championship so far this season, he's been a key man for them as well. So, it's great to see that he's on the spotlight. We don't have any of our Socceroos in the Premier League right now. So, good luck, Harry. Cross our fingers for you, big man.
And in Scotland, Cam Devlin backed up his Hearts debut with another start and a win over Dundee, while Tom Rogic helped set up Celtic's winner against Aberdeen, and he eased the pressure on Ange Postecoglou for at least a week, Michael.
He did. I watched the last 30 minutes of that game, and it was interesting because obviously we're all backing Ange, aren't we? We want him to do well, but it was... his team's trying to play the Ange ball, as they call it, and they were just obviously turning it over and making mistakes, and then Tom Rogic with a moment of brilliance and a beautiful through ball, and they got their win. So, yeah, Scottish football, SPL, it's hard to watch at times because
it's
it can
a tough
be,
watch. It's yeah, a really
lots of,
tough watch.
Lots of
time.
Mistakes.
I want to be positive.
Lots of mistakes. Yeah, you want to be positive, but it's pretty hard. And we know the challenge he's got. Most of his challenges are going to exist with how much time the fans are prepared to give him, and he needed that win and he got one, so well done.
To our Matildas, Mackenzie Arnold and Tamika Yallop were at the centre of the biggest shock of the week in the Women's Super League, with West Ham upsetting Manchester City 2-0. City had never lost to West Ham in the league and hadn't lost twice at home consecutively since 2014, but with Yallop in midfield and Arnold saving 7 shots on target, that all came unstuck, so well done to the two Matildas at West Ham. In the UEFA Women's Champions League, Sam Kerr scored the opener in what went on to be a 3-3 draw between Chelsea and Wolfsburg. Ellie Carpenter started for Lyon in their 3-0 win over Swedish side BK Häcken, and Dylan Holmes came off the bench. Not such great news at Arsenal, however. Steph Catley played 90 minutes as they went down 4-0 to Barcelona, with Caitlin Ford unable to influence proceedings off the bench. So that was a rare slip-up for the Arsenal women's side. Derek's going to have a little bit more on that in stoppage time. South Melbourne have succeeded in keeping Western United from playing matches at Lakeside Stadium, with the 7 fixtures this week moved to Amy Park. The APL's Greg O'Rourke confirmed the decision had been reached between the clubs, the state government, and the APL themselves, while South Melbourne president Nick Makoustas welcomed the announcement, as you'd expect. Lakeside Stadium is managed by the State Sports Centre Trust, so South Melbourne are technically just the tenants, but Rob, clearly they have a fair bit of say in this one. Old soccer has absolutely prevailed over new football, much to the delight of pretty much everyone except Western United. I've actually quite found the whole thing quite funny, to be honest.
Yeah, look, it does seem a little odd for the uninitiated. I mean, we have had South Melbourne's chairman, Bill Papastergiadis, on the show in the past, and you know they're very happy that they've won this battle. But you know, it's, you know, you're better equipped to explain the background to this. It's why can't they share? Tell us.
South Melbourne, this all gets back to when the old Middle Park ground was demolished for the Grand Prix, and they got Bob Jane Stadium, the old Bob Jane Stadium. How good was that? And they do have as leases have transpired and negotiations are underway, they do have a veto on football clubs that play there, and they've exercised that veto. They don't think that... the South Melbourne perspective is it's quite plausible. You didn't put us in the A-League. You said our stadium wasn't good enough. You said we weren't good enough, yet now you want to put the mob who should be playing in Tarnate in the inner southeast of Melbourne. I mean, what's going on here? Go back to Melbourne. They basically said to Western United, go back to Melbourne Victory and Melbourne City and ask them to let you play at Amy Park.
And meanwhile,
that's pretty much what happened, Willem.
Okay. And meanwhile, Western United are in talks with Essendon Football Club, of course, in the AFL, to use their training facilities at Tullamarine, Eggball, if you like. Should United gain access to the hangar, as it's called, they'd seek to retain a presence at their current setup at Sunshine George Cross. So, Michael, if that's approved, you can add the Bombers to Geelong and Western Bulldogs. As clubs Western United have sort of shacked up with in some way during their experience, they really do know no bounds in being not United, but Wanderers across pretty much the entirety of Victoria and Cross Coast as well.
Yeah, Willem, they were accepted into the A-League on the premise of the stadium. Western Melbourne is a soccer or football heartland, but there is just no suitable rectangular stadium. And West, you know, I do feel desperately sorry for them. The places they've played are all not suitable to get a conducive or really fantastic atmosphere. Cadinia Park in Geelong, up there at Mars Stadium in Ballarat, Witten Oval in Footscray. I mean, all of those places are just difficult places to get a great atmosphere and a great spectator experience. So they need that new stadium. They need to get the building works going to give confidence to the football community that they're in there for the long haul. I think they're going to make it. I think the stadium will be built. It's just obviously taking longer than what everyone would have hoped.
And to a quick A-League's transfer wrap to finish. Firstly, the A-League's themselves have added a new member this week with Isuzu signing on as the naming rights sponsor for the A-League men for 3 years.
So the... how do you say it? What's that? Give us the whole naming rights.
The whole naming rights name is Isuzu Ute A-League Men, and that is 18 letters, and that is a lot to carry around, and I should know because Willem van Denderen is 17 letters, so it's a huge effort, but it can be done. I did notice that every A-League club, bar Melbourne City, welcomed the deal on social media, and Rob, that is, of course, because they are a Nissan-sponsored club. But on a serious note, if we think back sort of 15 months or so, no TV deal, then a very short-term TV deal, no naming rights partner when Hyundai left. There were real concerns about the future of the league. So to look back on this now from a pretty rosy position, the game is certainly much healthier, and the APL and the Football Australia administration have done a damn good job considering where we were sitting not long ago.
Yeah, look, it's easy to be a critic by sort of having to pay at the... convoluted.
It's a long name.
A very long name. But I imagine there'll be some fun with it over time, and we'll just have to have some fun along with it. And the old Isuzu Ute, it's a pretty good truck. So maybe we might invite Isuzu to jump on board and participate with Box to Box one day. Hey,
Rob.
And we'll give it a full name when they do.
Rob, your oldest boy, Tom, is he going to walk down St. George's Road, Toorak, into your big mansion and say, come on, Dad, can you buy me an Isuzu Ute?
Yeah, that's what he'll be doing. Look, as I sort of, reverse the Maserati out past the Rolls Royce and all those sorts of things, I'll let him put the Isuzu next to it, Michael. Well done. All right, Willem, good stuff. Nice work. After the break, we're going to talk more A-League. Daniel Sturridge is going to arrive in Perth very, very soon. Terry McFlynn, the football operations manager at the Glory, is going to talk about this coup. The biggest signing in the A-League since Alessandro Del Piero. That's all next on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal.
Yes, this is Box to Box. Now, in any other week of the football year, the signing of a decorated Premier League player who had played for Liverpool, Chelsea, Manchester City would easily lead this story. So this show. So the fact that we're doing it a little bit later in the show is as big a shock to us as it is to anyone listening. But the story is still a huge one either way. He's going to Perth Glory. His name's Daniel Sturridge, and the man who helped to bring him over was Terry McFlynn. Terry, welcome to back to the show. What a huge story.
Yeah, look, obviously the club put out the press release last Friday morning, and it was received very, very well, not just for the football community here in Perth, but I think the general population as a whole. Obviously, there's a massive expat community here, and you know, as you said at the start of the show, Alan, someone like Daniel, profile, he's played in some of the biggest clubs in England, Man City, Chelsea, Liverpool, where he's obviously most famous and most well-known for. Was received very well. So there's been a bit of a buzz around the whole club and around the whole city.
Have you had a few calls from other football managers, your colleagues at other clubs, saying thank you very much, you've just added 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 people onto our crowd when we play Perth at home? Have you had a few people pat you on the back and say thank you very much?
Nah, look, I think the main thing for us is having conversations with Daniel and with his management company was that he's coming for the right reasons, and and it's to play football. You know, he's very hungry. He's a very humble player for the heights that he's played at. He's obviously had a bit of a time out of the game. But he's very hungry to come down here, and his main focus was joining in with his teammates, being part of the team, and fitting into the culture that we have here at Perth Glory. And as you say, look, the interest in Daniel right across the whole nation, not just here in Perth, has lifted the A-League, and I'm sure we'll see the crowd numbers will reflect that interest as well.
Tell us about whether Brad Jones helped with the recruitment. Obviously, they played together at Liverpool. I assume they know each other pretty well. Did Brad, did he chip in with a conversation here or there, and was he helpful?
Yeah, look, Brad was very helpful. You know, we obviously have a system and how we like to recruit, and Daniel was part of that process. And as we do with all potential recruits, we do a lot of due diligence, do a lot of homework in terms of personality. It's important for us to get the right people into the football club and enhance the culture that we're building and the culture that exists. So once we identified Daniel as a player that could obviously make a major difference to our team on the field, it was important for us to make sure that he was the right character and the right individual to fit into the club. So Brad, obviously, as you said, played with him for many years at Liverpool, spent a lot of time together. He spoke very, very highly of Daniel as a person, his characteristics, and then he actually spoke to Daniel as well, gave him a rundown on the club, on the city. Another person who was very helpful in the process was Robbie Fowler. Obviously, Robbie's a former Perth Glory player, lived in the city, knows the league very well from his time at not only Perth Glory, but also Brisbane Roar and North Queensland Fury. So they were both guys with great help in terms of giving Daniel and his people the information on the league, on the country as a whole. So yeah, look, it was a collective effort across the board.
How did you get a handle on what sort of shape he's in, and what can you expect his physical condition to be when he arrives?
Yeah, look, we've been very fortunate that, you know, in football you get to know a lot of people, and we managed to get our hands on a lot of his physical data, obviously with his permission and his previous club's permission. So we know where he's been at the peak of his career. We know where he's at physically now from the data we've collected. He's been training with Real Mallorca for an extended period of time. There was actually, they wanted to sign him, but obviously with the UK now and Brexit taking place earlier in the year, as a UK citizen, he's classed as a non-EU player on the European roster. So Mallorca had 3 non-EU players already on their playing roster, so they could sign Daniel now, but they couldn't register him until January. So that was a sort of a window for us to have the conversation and say, well, look, you know, we can come here and start playing straight away, which he wants to do, and wants to get on the grass and playing football as quickly as possible.
Daniel Sturridge is known as a striker, and he's a goal scorer. I'm sure he'll add a lot to the side in that way. But he's also quite a subtle player too. He's got great feet. He can bring other people into the game with his touches and his flicks. So do you see him as a sort of a pure goal scorer, or do you envisage some other kind of role for him in the side?
Yeah, look, first and foremost, he's a fantastic footballer. I think you've seen last season the way that we play. It's very fluid in attack, so we've got players that interchange positions. You know, we played with last season two number 10s at times. At times we played with 2 number 9s. So, look, for us, it's about getting the best players in on the park in this system where everyone's comfortable. But for sure, the one thing is that we need Daniel in the front third. That's obviously his major asset. That's obviously his attribute, is, as you said, scoring goals, bringing other people into play, and making things happen creatively in the front third. So yeah, for sure, look, he'll be changing positions, he'll be interchanging, but definitely in the front third is where Daniel can do his magic.
As Daniel outlined his goals to you guys, he's 32, so there's still plenty in the tank in terms of his career, provided he can stay fit. Do you know what his goals are? Is it just to play as much football as possible, or is there anything beyond that?
You know, when we're discussing the project with Daniel, one of the main things that he wanted to tick off from his side was to speak to Richard Garcia, our head coach, and his whole focus was obviously football. You know, when these sort of things come around and you're talking about contracts and deals and different things, it's important that the players have come for the right reason, and Daniel certainly made that clear that he was coming for football reasons. He wanted to speak to the coach about where he sees him playing in the team, what system we play, his roles and responsibility within that, not only with the ball, but obviously defensively as well, where the boss sees Daniel's best weapons and his best attributes that can help the team in the long run. So we haven't gone into specific individual goals with Daniel. That'll be a process that we go through with all, every player before the start of the season. So we're all aligned and we're all on the same page. But you know, for us, the main thing is to get him here fit and healthy and on the park.
What is the broader benefit amongst the squad when a marquee player comes in like that? How are the squad feeling about it? And what are the wider benefits to having Daniel Sturridge at Perth this year?
Yeah, look, for us, it was about, you know, when Richie took over coaching, obviously being a very proud Western Australian himself, we want to give as many young Western Australian players an opportunity. Young Western Australians came to Qatar with us. We came back subsequently, seven of them signed professional contracts. Six of them played in the A-League last season. So it was important for us not only just to give them an opportunity, but to help accelerate their development by bringing in good senior players around them to help with their development. And you know, I think if you bring in someone of Daniel Sturridge's quality, he's won the Champions League twice. Brad Jones has won the Champions League. Aaron Calver's won the A-League. Brandon O'Neill's won the A-League. So the players that we've brought in are winners. It's important for us to help the kids' development for the long-term sustainable success of Perth Glory. But certainly in Daniel's instance, he brings quality. He brings that experience of, you know, playing at the very, very top level for a long period of time, winning trophies. So for us, it's just an exciting prospect all around.
You obviously explained all of the football reasons why it's a good decision to recruit Daniel, but there's a lot of off-field reasons as well. So 2.3 million Twitter followers, 3.4 million Instagram followers, a signature dance goal celebration. I saw him on the project just a few nights ago where he performed very, very well. I mean, you in your role as a football manager, does that stuff come into... Does that all... part of the package, and did you think about the off-field impact he would have for Perth and the league, or are you just sort of focused on the football results?
No, I think you have to take everything into consideration, Michael. I think you have to chunk down each piece of the pie, if you like, and obviously his football component is there to see for everyone what he's done at the top level, playing for the clubs that we've mentioned previously and the trophies that he's won. Commercially, you look towards off-field stuff, how he can make an impact. Not only for the club, but for the league as a whole. And as you say, the social media presence in today's world, you know, it's massive. He did one post on Instagram shortly after the club did the official announcement, and I think within 1 hour it was viewed by 250,000 people. So these are the sort of things that, of course, you take into consideration, you take into account as to how you can actually showcase the club, how we can showcase the city, and how we can showcase the game as a whole here in Australia. And if you've got someone with not just a social media presence, but it's actually a global presence, in someone like Daniel Sturridge, and for us as a club, we have to capitalise on that as well.
And before we let you go, Terry, Richie Garcia, second season at the club after last season's COVID interruptions. It was a real roller coaster. I mean, there were times where you just looked like you were immoral for the finals, but then other times just the form fell away. How's Richie settling in as the gaffer, and what are your expectations around him as the boss for the second season in charge?
Yeah, excellent. Look, we came back in on the 19th of July in preparation for the FFA Cup, and unfortunately now COVID sort of disrupted that competition as well. So we've had an extended pre-season. As you said, last season we started off very well after coming back from Qatar for the Asian Champions League hub. And we used that as a good sounding board and as a good pre-season gelling session, if you like. When we came back, obviously we started very well, and then we had a period of time where we went to over east. We got caught with the COVID and obviously the border situation here in WA. We came back and we had to quarantine again, which made it very difficult. And we were sort of playing catch up from then on for the rest of the season. We then had seven games in 23 days, 24 days, I think it was, to finish the season. So we're basically playing every 3 days, which was a difficult period physically, but also mentally for the players. So that was sort of where the form fell away and the results obviously followed the form. So, but with a full pre-season under everyone's belt, everyone's here fit and healthy. And again, barring any unforeseen issues with borders and et cetera, I'm looking forward to the season. I think it'll be one that'll be very successful both on and off the park for Perth Glory.
Yeah, and for the A-League in general, we've got the new broadcasting deal with 10 Paramount. They would have been jumping out of their seats when they heard the news of Daniel's signings. That'll certainly put eyeballs on the television. So hopefully we're going to see crowds in the stadiums. We'll see a marquee player. We're still plenty left, as the boys said, in the tank, and an exciting season for your club ahead. Hey, Terry, thanks for joining us, mate. Good luck with everything. And it's only weeks away now, and we'll look forward to watching it all play out as the season unfolds.
Lovely. Thank you very much for your time, fellas.
Not at all. Terry McFlynn, legend of the A-League and current football operations manager at the Perth Glory. All right, stick around after the break. We'll bring it home with stoppage time. Still plenty of stories after what has been a bumper show.
Box to box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse,
home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King,
the kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal.
Yes, this is Box to Box. It's been a bumper show. We always think it is. We think it is. As I can hear Edge's dog wagging his tail in the background, or her tail in the background, for those eagle-eared listeners. Before we get into stoppage time, we've got a lot to talk about. I want to talk about Chemist Warehouse, because I do every week. And why do I do that? Because they are the best in the pharmacy business. So if you're running low on your everyday vitamins or cosmetics and you can't get to the shops, Chemist Warehouse has a solution. There are still a couple of the biggest states in this country in lockdown for a little while yet. So stock up on everything you need by shopping online at chemistwarehouse.com.au. Just spend $30 or more. We talked to you about this over the last couple of weeks. Chemist Warehouse will deliver your order within 3 hours for free. That's right, for nothing. That's just $30 at Chemist Warehouse, and they'll deliver your order within 3 hours. So go on, spoil yourself with your essential health and wellness needs with free delivery within 3 hours from Chemist Warehouse to your house. But you better hurry. This offer ends on October the 31st and excludes prescriptions and pharmacist-only medication. Selected stores only. Chemist Warehouse, fast delivery, powered by DoorDash. And the only thing I was missing there was my harmony singers. I mean, I knew Edge's mic was on because I could hear his dog in the background. I don't know why he wasn't tuning in. He does love to sing along. What was going on there, Edge?
I was muting my microphone because my dog's doing somersaults in the hallway and creating a lot of noise. And I know Damien, our tech guy, wouldn't like that.
That's all right. Well, we all know that we're working from remote scenarios, that it does happen. Derek, you're there. You've got your dog locked away safely and asleep, perhaps.
Yeah, no? Yeah. He spends many a day roaming the paddock in these days, but he's safely tucked away.
Beautiful. All right. Well, we've got a few things to cover. Now, you've been, as you would do, because the men's team don't win much, paying a lot more attention to the Arsenal women's side. And you want to talk about that for obvious reasons, Derek?
Yeah. I mean, I'll point out Arsenal men's are one of the most successful English clubs in the history of the sport. But leaving that aside, yeah, Arsenal women, do you know what? I need to give them more love. We've actually had them for a long time. They were one of the pioneering women's outfits for football before, I suppose, other clubs kind of joined the party in recent years. And, you know, they haven't been the most successful recently, albeit they used to, you know, they were number one for a long time. But they have started this season absolutely fantastically. They beat the champions, Chelsea, on the opening day of the season. They've actually beaten them twice this season, and they've beaten Spurs twice, 4-0 and 5-1, City 5-0, Reading 4-0. They did actually lose to Barcelona during the week, which ended that run of fixtures. Of course, a huge Australian connection. You know, Joe Montemiro was the coach, obviously, now at Juventus Women, and Jonas Erdevall's taken over, and of course, three of our Matildas in the side. And look, how much edge do you look at Arsenal, particularly with that Australian context? You know, are they building on the good work that Joe Montemiro put in place, and how are the girls going over there?
I think Steph Catley is well and truly one of the best players in the team. Caitlin Ford, the new coach Jonas Edvall, really hasn't used Caitlin starting very often, and She's been used as an impact player off the bench. And Lydia Williams has been in and out of the team as well. So there's a genuine battle on for the number one spot as goalkeeper. So they're all making a good contribution, but Steph Catley is the Rolls-Royce of those three. She's really playing well, and in her position that she played when Alan Stajcic was the coach of the Matildas in that left-back position, she's overlapping and doing very, very well. She's played in a few different positions in the Matilda setup for, I think, the necessity of recent times, but they're doing really well. And, Jonas Edvald's opening months, as you mentioned, they've been nothing short of sensational. They've really been a team to watch in that competition. However, it seems to me they're still a little way away from being benchmark when it comes to Barcelona and Olympic Lyon, which are the two super clubs. So I'm just thinking that they've got a little way to go before they're going to be competitive in the Champions League. But I think the Australians and Arsenal women in general are doing very well. And it's obvious that Jonas Edvald has been leveraging off the fine work of Joe Montemiro.
Tell us about one of their other superstars, non-Australian, Vivian Miedema. I mean, I've seen a few goals. She's a scorer of beautiful goals. Statistically, she's got 64 goals in 70 games. She's only 25 years old. I mean, for listeners that are maybe not familiar with her, I mean, what kind of, you know, player is she and how good is she?
Oh, she's a dominant striker. You know, I saw her at the World Cup in France just take teams apart. She was a big reason why the Netherlands made it through to the final. She's got a lot of talent. She's got a huge presence. I understand that she's a very strong personality and a great leader. And she's really the talisman of that current Arsenal women's team. And I think we're seeing the emergence of a world superstar. We really are. Yeah.
At the same time as the Women's Super League goes from strength to strength in the UK, a great positive sign for women's football in a difficult week on the domestic front in Australia. Guys, the Premier League is taking a break with the international fixtures that are on this weekend. But there are a lot of stories from the opening couple of months or nearly a couple of months of the competition so far. But there is no better story than Brentford and what they've done. They just missed out the season prior, but since they've come in, they've just been such a bright, shining story in all of this. Thomas Frank is an amazing manager, the rock star on the sidelines. Derek, I mean, there's just so much to like about this.
Yep, certainly. Number one, they've never been here before, and I think we always like to see a team come up for the first time. It's really interesting because, you know, we've had teams like Leeds last season and other teams that come flying out of this championship, and they just take to the Premier League like a duck to water. Quite often it's because they play a different kind of football, or that they're tactically really sound. It's incredible really seeing Norwich on the other side of the scale. You know, they were champions of the championship. They were the best team to come into the Premier League, and yet they're really struggling. They've picked up where they've left off in terms of when they were last in the Premier League. Whereas I think we all had a feeling about Brentford. You know, we saw that first game of the season when Arsenal were going there, and I think we all looked at that and went, here we go. And look, to be honest with you, you know, the longer that the season's gone on, the better I'm feeling about that result. And to be honest, I wasn't too despondent after it, because I just knew by reputation how good this team is. They've got a fantastic new stadium. It's a vibrant part of London. They've got a Danish manager who really does have he plays the high press, he plays counter-attacking football, he's got dominant players, physical athletes all over the pitch. Tony and Mbeumo up front scoring the goals. Ray is a fantastic goalkeeper. And look, they beat West Ham in their last game, and West Ham were, you know, the bolter, so to speak, in last season. They played well. I mean, West Ham were a little unlucky, I think. They played quite well in the second half, but Brentford came and snatched it with a fine goal. I'll just kind of edge. I mean, you're kind of imbued with US football and Sports Edge and the Moneyball, and Brentford have really taken that on board in terms of the way that club is run and the recruitment. But maybe for listeners that are not familiar with that concept, what does it mean that Brentford have taken a Moneyball approach to running their team?
Rather than using, you know, club networks, relationships, people's opinions of players, they've used hard data to analyse the aspect of those players. And you'd have to say, at the moment, with 12 points from 7 games, that that's a pretty good strategy. And we know that there is an emerging wave of data analytics being used by all clubs, but Brentford has taken it to the extreme, and they are in fact using, you know, if you've seen the movie Moneyball, they're using a similar strategy to measure players' performances based on statistical analysis, and that's who they're recruiting. Obviously the coach has got to meld them together, and he's doing that, but 12 points from 7 games, we all thought that they would surprise, but you know, they're sitting above Arsenal, Leicester and Tottenham on the ladder. It's a remarkable story, Derek.
It is. And look, a fascinating thing quickly about them is that they actually abandoned an academy. They don't have an academy. It was actually costing them money. They weren't making anything out of it. They were quite often, you know, having their talent poached by the bigger teams. And as you said, they found it easier to not have an academy and then look for players who were in the likes of Arsenal, Chelsea, Tottenham, West Ham academies that maybe didn't make it, and looking at that raw data and then bring those players in. It's a much cheaper exercise. And of course, if one of them comes good, then they make a profit. But Willem, we were talking about the disparity about, you know, how Brentford have been successful, but there are other teams that come up that aren't successful. What's the point you want to make there?
Clubs such as Brentford and Leeds are doing things differently. We have seen sides such as Norwich, Fulham and Watford over previous years. They're good enough in the Championship, but they go about things in a pretty similar sort of way, and they get up and they go straight back down. So do you think there is a right and wrong way to do something emerging over the past 5 or so seasons, back yourself in at Championship level and continue to do so once you come up into the Premier League, rather than sort of trying to maintain the status quo in the Championship and then following on with sort of dour and that sort of performance in the Premier League, if you get what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, look, I think it's purely a momentum and attitudinal thing. I mean, yeah, teams that come through the playoffs, they're not necessarily the highest ranked team, but they come in with a lot of momentum. And I just feel like teams that have a unique style and a unique identity, and that they're actually positive, as you kind of said, about being in the league and realizing that they can compete. And as you said, teams that play on the back foot, maybe look for, you know, to reduce the damage and to be more defensive, are kind of being picked off by Premier League teams. So I think there is something in just having a spirit and attitude and a philosophy that really works in the Premier League. Edge, just finally, we want to touch on La Liga quickly. Barcelona are 0-2 in the Champions League. They've just lost 2-0 to Atletico, and Suarez, their ex-player who they basically gave to Atletico, got on the score sheet. They're in ninth position. They've got the likes of Braithwaite and Luke de Jong up front. Koeman's floundering. They can't sack him because they can't afford to sack him. But what next for Barcelona? Can they stick with Koeman for the rest of the season?
I think they're going to have to. I note a few weeks ago, Rob took me to task when I said that we could be seeing the end of Barcelona. But let me just put that in a little bit of context for Rob. I'll just do that for you, Rob, and everybody else
who's
listening.
Michael. I mean, not that you would be
condescending. Real Madrid, for example, Real Madrid is spending £560 million more than Barcelona on wages this season. Barcelona, they're in financial meltdown. They've got reporting losses of €480 million. They have their spending power has dropped to 14th ranked in the competition. They are just an average club at the moment, and they've got average players, and you know, they are looking at a budget forecast loss of €650 million this season. It's just extraordinary. This club is potentially at risk, and I know Rob will probably take me to task over that, but financially they are in a hole that they may not recover from, and they're going to need support from the governing body to keep going.
But that was my point a couple of weeks ago when you raised it. Yeah. I mean, in all seriousness, they are just one of those clubs that's too big to fail. I mean, let's look at our clubs, Arsenal, Liverpool. Can you imagine a Premier League without them? It's just impossible for me to get my head around. I mean, look, the bigger organisations have failed and have gone the way of the dodo outside of sport in the past. But, I'm more inclined to think that if they keep falling down the ladder the way they are, that they might sort of the relegation conversation might start. But I can't see them failing, Michael. I don't think that's going to happen. What we do need to do, though, gentlemen, is probably park that conversation for another day, because it does warrant more discussion, and bring this thing home. Thank you for another week, Derek. It's been good again.
Yes, thank you, gents.
Willem, you're still there, I think, in the corner.
I am. It's always good, Rob. Thank you very much, and speak to you next week.
Excellent. And Michael, you're jumping on a big bird this weekend for the first time in a long, long time.
Yeah, I've got some urgent business that needs to be attended to, so I will be recording this show from all sorts of far-flung places over the next couple of months, Rob. So yes, I do, not without a little bit of apprehension, obviously, with the current status of the world, but I'm backing the vaccination and my ability to attach a mask to my face for the next couple of months, so I should be okay. And I'm looking forward to maybe giving a little bit of insight into the traveling throughout the world to do business in the COVID era, just to see whether some of our listeners might be just interested in some of my experiences over the next little while. But I'm heading off to the Middle East shortly, and looking forward to catching up with some colleagues that I've worked with for a long time that I have not had an opportunity to see for a little while. Yeah,
excellent, mate. All right, well, bon voyage, safe travelling. We'll be waking you up at all hours of the morning to do the show. It'll be interesting chatting to you, finding out what's going on around the world. Just a little under 12 months, I think it is, before the World Cup in Qatar, as you get prepared for it. Damo, thank you for all your work, mate. It has been a complex show this week, but we hope you've enjoyed it, and we do hope you join us next week when we go from one end of the pitch to the other in the World Game.